Next case is 99-342-348-618, Martin Holcomb versus State Farm Insurance Company.
Start, may I start?
Absolutely.
You were here not long ago arguing a case Wolf versus Wolf.
That's correct.
Is that correct? Isn't that dispositive of this case, no matter what we do with it?
I believe it is on the particular issue. I'd like to address just briefly the facts that put this in the same category. We have a two-year issue based upon one of the policies here, and that is the policy of Martin Holcomb. Martin Holcomb policy is a replacement policy that starts as of March 1994. The policy indicates that it's the C portion, the B portion of the policy, where the former policy is the A portion of the policy. That portion of the record is before the court. That's what the Court of Appeals is indicating. Based upon the fact that the March 1994 policy of Martin Holcomb is a new policy, and the declaration statement indicates that. We then have the two-year statute. Then says we've got guaranteed coverage between March 94 and March 1996, which means the policy starts in 1994 prior to SB20. And so therefore, at least under the Martin Holcomb policy, that should be controlled by the two-year rule and control. The other issue that I want to address in a great deal of detail today is one that this court hasn't had a chance to hear in detail.
Unless we say the two-year policy is all renewals, and it's a brand new policy after the 2 years, and they only have to do it for 6 months, then it would be the opposite of what you just said. I mean, you're assuming by that argument, are you not, that we're going to say that 39-37-31A says a two-year policy, period.
Yes, that makes that assumption, of course, that there is a statutory two-year policy period. Yes, that's correct.
Now, when again did these policies go? What was the original policy date here?
Well, we don't have the exact...
It's not here.
...the guaranteed period.
Why does nobody ever tell us about that when that's one of the... That's your first proposition of law.
Well, that is something I think that we would ultimately need to find out. When is the initial date of the policy? And having not been a public counsel, I'm not in a position to know that.
Do we know at least this, that it was a new policy in 1994?
That's correct. That's what it indicates.
What date, even though it says renewal, or?
It's replacement.
Replacement. That's a whole another term yet. But it says replacement, so it obviously is replacing something else.
That's right.
But it's a new policy as of what date? Before October 20th, 1994?
That's right.
Okay. So your argument is that it's a policy, new policy, before October 20th, 1994. Therefore, regardless of the constitutional issues, Savoy applies, not Senate Bill 20.
That's correct.
Doesn't that end this case if that were found?
It ends the case as far as the Martin policy goes, which is the father's policy. The stepfather's policy, the other policy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the longer this court has to address the issue about the SB 20 law, because SB 20 law, no matter what we do, is going to apply to that particular policy. That's what I want to get into in terms of the setoff. This court has been asked to consider that the setoff under A2 is a setoff policy limits. And I want to address this issue in two parts. First of all, what is the setoff? Is it policy limits, or is it not available for payment? And then secondly, documents that indicated the amount actually reported by the insured was deleted by the SB 20 statute. Therefore, the defense is arguing that that somehow makes a difference in this case. That is clearly not the case. This case they revoked the Andrews decision, the pre-SB 20 law. Andrews solely deals with the language of amount available for payment. He never mentioned once this additional language about amount received. They solely analyze the language about available for payment and make their decision on the language amount available for payment. And that language is kept by the SB 20 statute, and the Andrews decision on that issue applies. If that were not the case, then we would have a very big quandary under the statute, because you would never have an underinsured motorist claim with a 12-5 policy, right? Because in order to have an underinsured claim, the tort feasor has to have at least 12-5. If the underinsured coverage were also 12-5, if defendant is correct, there is no conceivable set of circumstances under which there would be an underinsured claim for that 12-5 policy. That would be buying the insurance industry an awful big class action lawsuit, or selling a type of coverage, underinsured motorist coverage, in 12-5 policies, which by law people are precluded from recovering.
Well, could they be just selling the, in that instance, could they just be selling uninsured?
Well, that's essentially what they would be doing, but according to the statute, you have to offer both. Because you're paying a premium for both. And therefore, if you're paying a premium for two and you're only getting one, that's clearly something wrong there. If we go to the second stage, when we look at amount available for payment, which I think this court must get to the second stage, the question then becomes available to whom? And here's where it gets really interesting. The statute says, the first reference says, amount available to the insured, the being singular. Well, the question then becomes, in this case, how is our case different from the prior Holt decision? If you follow me with the facts, you'll see how the two cases are completely different. Holt was a situation in which the deceased was the only insured under the policy. The beneficiaries were not. That is not the circumstance here. We've got a father and four children, five total beneficiaries, who are insureds under both policies. We've got dad's policy, stepmom's policy. Dad and all four kids are insured under both policies. So we had one insured in Holt, which then came up for estate. And we technically have not only the deceased being insured here, but all the beneficiaries being insured as well. What that means is we have to take a look at the actual language of the statute. And if it says set off amounts available to be insured, well, we've got five insureds here. So what do you do? The insured is not singular in this situation. We've got five of them. So the only way to read that statute in the context of this case is a set-off with regard to each respective insured. And that is consistent with what was done in the Durr case, which you're all familiar with. Durr was a wrongful death claim. What the Supreme Court held was that set-off must be done with respect to each separate beneficiary. And that's very consistent with what the statute does, because it says amount available to the insured, verified insured, you have to go with respect to each one. So what would we have in a situation like this? We now have the estate that's recovered $25,000 in tort fees and was divided five ways. We now have $75,000 that was recovered under the stepmom's policy. That was divided five different ways. Theoretically, what you would have under this set of facts would be an additional $20,000 in underinsured motorist coverage, because we take a look at any one of the five beneficiaries and say they each got $5,000 apiece. There's $100,000 available. There should be $95,000 available to one. And then you go to the second beneficiary, there's $5,000 left. So that $5,000 of the $100,000 would then go to the second beneficiary. So in this particular circumstance, there would be an additional $25,000 of coverage available. That is also consistent with the uninsured motorist statute. Here's the way it would work. If we have a 100-300 policy and we had the wrongful death in this claim, even if SB 21 were to apply, you would have $100,000 in available coverage that would be available to all the entire members of the estate. That is exactly what we're doing under the underinsured coverage as well, 25 from the tort cases. And there would also be 100 available in underinsured coverage collectively distributed among the various beneficiaries. So we have the same result, whether this for uninsured motorist coverage or underinsured motorist coverage. Next issue I want to address is one that this court has heard before, it's the Sexton issue. And I just want to address a couple of issues.
If you follow Sexton, doesn't that decide the other issues in Holcomb?
Well,
in this
yes
particular
no.
case?
Yes and no, because this is a very interesting situation where we have claims of the decedent under the same policies that you have the Sexton claims.
Mm-hmm.
Not like most of the claims you have, where dad has his own policy and the beneficiaries aren't insured under the estate, and dad just simply goes after his own policy. Dad is insured under the policy, and all the kids are insured under the same policy. So you have Sexton claims under the same policy that the whole claim exists in, which is a very kind of unique circumstance here.
In Sexton, the daughter was not insured under the father's policy.
That's right. Here, all of them are insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get to a Sexton claim in a situation like this, the theory behind Sexton is that each one of us should be able to pre-insure ourselves on our own interests. We buy insurance to pre-insure what we anticipate happening. And the only way to allow people to pre-insure themselves up to whatever limit it is to allow a Sexton claim. Here's the example as to why you don't allow people to pre-insure themselves otherwise. In a divorce situation like this, dad has very little control, or her husband has very little control over ex-wife. He can't tell ex-wife what to buy. By the same token, they couldn't even handle the divorce together, let alone determine what kind of insurance coverage they're going to carry together. So dad, Mark Holcomb, in order to protect his own interests, has only one policy that he can buy from, and that's his own. Otherwise, he's subject to the whim of whatever the tortfeasor carries, whatever the whim of somebody else carries under the policy, under their own policy. So the only way he can pre-insure his own interests is to purchase his own policy and then make a Sexton claim under that own policy. If you understand that that's the basic theory behind the Sexton claim, everything else falls into place. Because it doesn't matter now whether you have, as Gallagher will point out to you, you have a conflict between the wrongful death statute because only one party makes the claim on behalf of the wrongful death. There are two separate claims here. One is for wrongful death, as handled by the estate. And the other is the Sexton claim, which is the individual's own claim. In this case, Martin or Dad's own personal claim. So that those two do not conflict. When Mr. Gallagher wants to talk about impairment of subrogation rights, that is not going to apply if you have coordination simply of what's going on with the different policies. If the estate wants to settle with the tortfeasor and doesn't want to step on the toes of the Sexton claims, then all the executor of the estate has to do is call up all the family members. He knows who they are. He's kind of hidden people to say, hey, are you making a Sexton claim under your policy? If you are, tell me, and I will give the tortfeasor and your underinsured carrier a chance to do the Sexton. So it's not that hard to coordinate this type of stuff.
A chance what?
To consent. As far as waiver of subrogation goes.
That and for exhaustion.
Exactly. So this is not the type of situation where it's impossible for the various parties who are involved to prohibit engaging in something that should happen and allow these people to pre-insure themselves. So that I'll defer the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenberg. Mr. Gallagher.
This morning, may it please the court, my name is Jim Gallagher. I'm here on behalf of the Appellee Cross Appellate State Farm. I have a procedural question for you. First, am I allowed any rebuttal time on my cross appeal?
Yes.
In that case, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for the talk. First of all, I have somewhat of a dispute with some of the statements made by Mr. Rosenberg, and the first one would be in regards to the chronology of the case. Justice Douglas, you asked what the chronology of the policies was, and I think that is a significant question. The chronology of this case is as follows. October 20th, 1994, a sentence of the 20 took effect. March 14th, 1994, one policy expired, and that policy renewed. August 17, 1995, the second policy had its guarantee period expire, and the policy renewed.
Okay, you say expired. That means you go back 2 years.
That's correct, Your Honor. I can show you.
That means it would be before October 20th, 1994.
What I'm saying is that the one policy had a guarantee period from March of 93 to March of 95.
Okay.
The second one had one from August of 93 to August of 95.
Both before October
20, 1994. Right. And those both ran their full course. In 1995, they expired, and then the action occurred after that. So if there is a new guarantee period, it would have begun after Senate Bill 20 was all filed. And the places where that isn't referenced, you can find the declaration page attached to the supplements to the appellant's first merits brief. It's a supplement page 2. It's a copy of the declarations page, and right on there it says guarantee period March 1493 to March 1495. For the second policy, that's on supplement page 35. And that sets forth the guarantee period of August of 93 to August of 95. And in the record also, that is something that the Court of Appeals actually did look at. And you can find that attached to the appellant's first merit brief. And the appendix, page 6. You'll see that it says, according to the declaration pages corresponding to each policy, Mark Holton's policy originally was issued on March 14, 1993, and Linda Holton's policy was issued on August 27, 1993. So we've got a situation here where both policies began in 93, had a two-year guarantee period expire in 95 before this accident occurred.
So you're arguing that after the two-year period now, it's a brand-new policy?
I'm arguing that every 6 months, it's a brand-new contract. But even if you take the argument by Mr. Rosenberger, I should still prevail, because he's arguing it ought to be a two-year policy.
If it's a brand-new contract every 6 months, then it goes for two more years. Then it would be, the original contract would be in effect, or the renewed one, before October 20.
Your Honor, there's...
See, that's the problem. You, not you, but... Somebody coming in arguing in the Wolf case last week, the lawyer for the insurance company, says, oh, no, it's a brand new policy every 6 months, but it's a renewal.
Your Honor, can I point out that there's two different words being used, and I think some of the confusion in this area of the law is because some of the terms are being misused or slopped together, and that is this. Mm-hmm. In the Benson versus Roster decision, the Supreme Court in that particular case said that where policies of insurance renew every 6 months, the renewals of those policies can be considered new contracts. And in that, the Supreme Court is saying, look, this is the same policy all along, whether it was last for 15 years. But the question is that renewal a new contract? And there's a difference between those two words.
Yeah, and Benson slopped them together, didn't it?
No, I don't think so. They particularly separated them. They said where you can have the same policy that renews on the basis of consecutive six-month contracts. When this court decided the case of Ross versus Farmers, it used the exact same language out of the title language out of Benson. In Ross versus Farmers, you said that statutes pertaining to policies of insurance and its coverage may be incorporated into any renewal where such renewal constitutes a new contract of insurance separate from the initial policy.
And that's why I made it clear, it is a new contract. That's why I use that language. Isn't there parentheses there, too?
I didn't write my notes parentheses, Your Honor. But I would submit this, that there is a difference between a policy and a contract. And I think the law provides for that, and Benson provides for that. I can get a policy in 1980 and keep renewing that every 6 months. And it's still the same policy, but every 6 months I've got a new contract with my insurer. And let me ask you this.
That has to go for 2 years.
I have to offer to renew it for 2 years, according to 3937.31. The policyholder doesn't have to agree to pay.
Right. And at the end of the two-year period, it's a brand-new contract then, brand-new policy.
I would ask the court to consider it this way. Let's say that somebody comes to me, I'm the insurer, and they want to contract with me for insurance for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I say, fine, here's your policy of insurance, and the declarations pages, just like the ones before this board, say, I'm going to insure you from January 1st to June 1st of January 1st to July 1st of 19...
6 months.
6 months. And that's all it says. And they pay me $100 for that coverage, and now we've got a contract. I agree to cover you for 6 months, no more, no less. You agreed to pay me the $100. That's a 6 month contract. Now, what happens during that first 2 years? By statute 39, 37, 31, I, as the insurer, have to put a tail on that contract and offer. I have to come to you at the end of 6 months and say, Justice Douglas, would you like another 6 month term? And if you do, I'm going to recalculate the premium and the consideration, so we're going to have different terms. It's going to be a different 6 months covered. There's going to be a different amount of consideration, and I've got a new and independent offer.
No, no, no. You're renewing the policy.
I'm agreeing to enter into a new contract with you. And I'm agreeing to renew the policy. It's both. It's a renewal of the policy and it's a contract.
Okay, then at that point, you have to issue, offer to me uninsured, underinsured coverage under 39.37.18 if it's a new policy every time.
No, it's the same policy. And again, these are the words that are being used by the court of justice. And I think, again, that's a significant distinction. And so at the end of the 6 months, if you say, no, I don't want any more coverage, do I have any rights against you? Can I sue you and make you pay? No, and the reason for that is because there's no contract.
But if you refuse to give it to me, I have a cause of action against you.
All I have to do is offer, and if you accept it, you're right, I have to give it to you.
Okay.
And at the end of that 6 months, I've got to offer it again. You don't have to take it. And at the end of that 6 months, I have to offer it again. You don't have to take it. And at the end of that, I don't have to offer it.
Doesn't there have to be some alterations, though, in the second 6 months to make it a new contract if it's just the same and same premium is being paid, or even an increase that would be the same contract as the initial?
There are alterations, and Your Honor, in two respects. One would be the consideration, and number two is the time period. See, all insurance really is an agreement to protect you for a certain amount of time. The first contract was from January to July. The second same difference for the next contract is July to December. And if you don't think that's significant, have an accident in December when you haven't renewed your contract. See, that's all these insurance policies are. It's an agreement to protect you during some 6 month period.
And
that period
is the contract. It's just
the
contract.
Buying a lumber and paying an extra price, you're buying the same product over and over and over. The terms may not change, but you have to enter a new contract by the product.
It's the same thing. It would be the same thing. It's just a new contract each time. And I submit to the board that in Benson, this exact issue was raised. I'd like you to consider this. In Benson, here's what you have. And that's on page 44 of the opinion, if you go back and look at it, you have a policy that was issued on May 6th of 1980. You have a statutory amendment that precluded stacking, which went into effect a month later on June 25th of 1980. You then had some people involved in an accident in November of 81, which was within the first 2 years. And then their guarantee period expired in May of 85. So it's exactly the situation you're talking about. And the issue posed in Benson was, can you take advantage of this new statutory provision within the two-year guarantee period? And in Benson, the court said, yes, you can, so long as these renewals constitute new contracts.
And a new policy.
Same policy, new contracts.
That was a 4-3 case, too, wasn't it?
It was a majority opinion, yes, sir. I submit it was solid in Benson, but it is a binding majority opinion.
Yeah.
In my case, the facts are even stronger. We had the guarantee period expire before this accident ever occurred. And that's in the record, and it's also a finding by the Court of Appeals.
Counsel, could you move to the Sexton issue?
Whether or not the statute supersedes Sexton? Yes, Your Honor, I'd be glad to. In 1982, the Supreme Court decided the Sexton case, and the question there was whether or not a person insured by the policy had to sustain a bodily injury in order for there to be coverage. And in that case, the court said, although the statute doesn't indicate who must sustain the injury, it does not specify as being insured, and we will not have that limitation. Well, what happened then is that in 1994, Senate Bill 20 added a clause indicating that the bodily injury case to examine the issue, has dispensed with it easily, saying that that clause is absolutely clear and conspicuous and there's no ambiguity in it, except for the board in this case. Since the Holcomb decision was decided by the Court of Appeals, it has been considered by other appellate courts. They summarily rejected it. Matter of fact, in Spence, they said, we do not find the Holcomb Court's position tenable, given the clear and precise wording of the statute. Now, this clause was added, this clause indicating that somebody has to sustain the bodily injury in three different sections of the statute. And the wording is similar, but not identical. It's contained in paragraph A of the statute, where it says, unless both of the following coverages are provided to persons insured under the policy for loss due to bodily injury or death suffered by such persons. It's in paragraph 1 slightly differently. It's in paragraph A2 slightly differently, even again. But the significant thing is that clause, suffered by any person insured under the policy, was stuck in that statute three times. And each and every single time it follows the word bodily injury or death, the term that the appellant's claim is modified to word loss isn't even contained in all three paragraphs of the statute.
Oh, yeah, it is. 3937-18A, just before the 1.
It's in A, the word loss is in
A. So it is there.
Right, but it's not in B.
You said it's not in the statute.
No, I said it's not contained in all three paragraphs of what I meant to say. So it can't be intended to modify the word loss. They didn't even put loss in paragraph 81. Why would you put a modifying clause in three paragraphs and not even include the word you want to modify?
They put loss in A, and in A1 they use damages.
That's correct.
And the question is whether bodily injury modifies that or single insured. And that's the question we have to decide. We've got that before us.
Right. And there's Supreme Court authority, Your Honor, that indicates, and this is significant not just for this insurance type of litigation, because we've been fighting about this for years. But this is significant because you're going to be dealing with a rule of statutory construction that deals with every other case involving a statute that comes before you. And the Supreme Court decided back in 1946 in Carter versus Division of Water that a qualifying word refers solely to the last antecedent. And the legislature is deemed to know the decisions of this court, and they've been writing statutes since 1946 and before, relying upon this court's authority.
And specifically, in Senate Bill 20, said they were superseding Savoy, and by absence, they did not say Sexton.
That's correct. They did many other things, and they didn't cite the other cases, too. And certainly there's no requirement that they cite a case in order to supersede.
Well, but you're arguing to us that they know our cases, and they know what to do with them. And they did in Savoy, but they didn't with Sexton.
I would submit this, Your Honor, because they did take the time to add that three paragraphs of the statute. And they must have had a reason. And the reason either was to supersede Sexton or codify. Now, if they're trying to codify Sexton, I think they could have done a heck of a lot better in writing the statute than would have done that. I submit that the court would have said that the statute must provide coverage for damages due to bodily injury, sickness, disease, or death, regardless of whether it was sustained by insurers. And they didn't do that. And I submit that when you look at this statutory framework, that's exactly what they were trying to do, was to supersede a Sexton case. Where this court said, we're not going to put that requirement in, or we're not going to enforce it in the requirement that the insurer sustain a bodily injury until the legislature sticks it in the statute. And I think it's just extremely significant that every appellate court to consider the issue has come to that conclusion, other than the one in Franklin County. And frankly, when you've got 12 decisions and only one out of 12 disagrees, I think that speaks very clearly as to what the legislature agreed. I'd like to reserve our vote.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher. Mr. Thibault, you have to be a transfer. You can take 12. I have a Thibault. Give about a minute.
Start with the Sexton issue first. Mr. Gallagher indicates that language was added three times, but we don't know why that language was added. It's a problem. It can be interpreted in a number of different ways. If you look at the language suffered by the insured, that simply reinforces the requirement that it has to be an insured making any claim under that policy. As you all know, there was a big debate for many, many years in many courts of appeals as to whether the decedent had to be insured, whether a beneficiary had to be insured, or what have you, in order to make a claim under the policy. Why can't you read that language to simply be a codification of that, that they are simply reinforcing the fact that you have to be an insured under the policy in order to make a claim. There is nothing that requires this court to interpret that language as overruling those sections. And as Mr. Gallagher said, they could have written it a lot more clearly. That's absolutely right. This is very clear. I think everybody would agree with that. And the problem he has is it can be interpreted in several different ways. Now, Mr. Gallagher indicated there are 12 decisions going his way, and that may or may not be true depending on how you interpret those. The most important thing you have to realize is what's the rationale behind those decisions. None of those decisions, to my knowledge, well, we're free to read them, talk about what we do in our brief, and that is the noun and the prepositional phrase. Mr. Gallagher is correct that as a general rule, you look at the antecedent noun. But what do you do if that noun is within a prepositional phrase? And I've cited to you chapter and verse from a number of grammar books indicating that if an object is within the prepositional phrase, you look at the noun before the prepositional phrase. In this case, depending upon which brief section that statute would be loss or damages. And that's what you take a look at in this case. Now, the two-year issue. The one thing
that's the one I'm concerned about. He says that this accident occurred after a new policy came into effect after October 20, 1994. You seem to say that that's not so.
That's
you
correct.
Both can't be right.
And that's in regard to one policy. Take a look there. What happens is March 14th of 1994 on the Mark & Fulcrum policy.
Yes.
The policy period of March 14th of 94 to September 14th of 1994. Indicate on the bottom of that deck sheet is a replaced policy. It says replaces policy 35A. The new policy number is now 35B. What I'm indicating to this court, Mr. Gallagher is correct regarding the guarantee periods, but that's not what we're talking about here. We now have a new policy as of March 14th of 1994, changed by the insurance company. It's argued as a replacement policy and even says new policy form. My point is, new policy, new two-year period starts March 14th of 1994.
Yeah, I understand.
The guarantee period started in 1993. And that's what makes the Martin Fulcrum policy subject to the two-year rule. And that's why this court also has to decide the other Fulcrum policy in accordance with SB 20. And that's why this court has to address the issues of Sexton and Setoff and what have you with regard to that policy. The court does not have to address those issues with regard to Martin's whole time, because that would be governed by Savoy law.
Thank you. You got to use 4 seconds. Thank you.
Mr. Again, Your Honor, regarding the declarations page, that's in supplement number 2, it specifically sets forth on their guarantee periods March 14th, 93 and March 14th, 95. The term guarantee period is a term of art defined by statute.
Yeah, but if it becomes a new policy, you and I agreed that you have to, that it starts a whole new 2 year period. Isn't that correct?
It was a new policy, not a new contract.
All right. But what does it say at the bottom?
In this case,
the part I read where it says new policy.
That's a new policy form.
Or would you put an old policy on a new policy form?
Well, Your Honor, this document doesn't say when it took effect.
Okay.
At the top right, the date that Mr. Rosenberg is using is up at the top right corner, or just in the case of the policy period, which is for another 6 months,
okay.
We're talking about March 14th of 94 to September 14th of 1994. That's fine. That's consistent with the bottom that says that this is one of the renewals in that first 2 years that's required by law. So there isn't really any consistent with that. Now they revised the policy form and gave it to them. That's fine. There's no indication it's in the contract. My last comment would be in regards to the set-off issue. Your Honor, it's our position that set-off issue, the fallacy of the argument is this. 3937-18H says that all claims arising out of a single bodily injury are, number one, considered one claim for insurance purposes, and number two, may be subject to a single each person limit coverage. When he claims that all the young kids have their own claims and you should look at those independently, by statute, they don't have all the claims. They have one claim for insurance purposes.
Thank you, Mr. Gavin. Case submitted, you'll be advised of our opinion. Marshall, please.
All rise. Hear ye, hear you, it's also silent.